This is Phil Ferrand, and I am driving home. It's Thursday today. I'm not coming in tomorrow unless there's a problem. it is episode 367, I think. All is well. I do have to drop off some mail in a mailbox as we're going, so we're going to take a little detour and get that done. But aside from that, all is well. All is moving along. We're making progress. Had a nice breakfast today with a friend. Got a breakfast tomorrow with another friend. Got a breakfast the next day with another friend. So they're going to be a whole bunch in a row here. Bam, bam, bam. But that's okay. I always enjoy getting together with friends and chatting. Just chatting about life. It's good. I have started book 5 now. I think I had mentioned last week that I was either going to start it or I was finishing up on all the tasks. Got those tasks done. Went through book 3 and added in all the things into my database that had happened in book 3. All the little sporadic things so that I could refer back to them later. Of course, got all the beta books delivered last week, sent all mailed and ta-da-ta-da, got that taken care of. And so now it's just a matter of putting down 10,000 words a week for the next 8 weeks. Try to get to 80,000 words. We'll see. It's always a little bit of a challenge to get started again, But I think I'm started, I think, on book 5. I think I am. First, I wasn't quite sure, but... And I'm not... This book, this is going to be an interesting book, because there is this outstanding question that I've had in my mind. And if you haven't read the books, this isn't really a spoiler, but it's just one of those things. There are tactical teams on the Dominion. They are led by a man named McDuff, Gabriel McDuff, Master Sergeant, big barrel-chested man, you know, big guy, blah, 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 you know the type. So anyways, he leads the tactical teams. Very disciplined, skilled fighter, yada, yada. He also happens to be the one who traditionally in these books so far has given the viewpoints that I'm trying to highlight on the parables of Jesus. So he isn't the resident preacher, but he is the resident wise man for the teachings of Christ, which surprised my son-in-law when he read the first book. He said, I didn't expect McDuff to be the one to be talking about the principles of the kingdom. And I did that intentionally because I loved the juxtaposition of that. The juxtaposition of the warrior prophet. You know, I loved that idea. But eventually, the idea is going to come home to roost. Because we do have to explain how the one who supposedly is the one who has the most interesting understanding of the kingdom of God, the kingdom Jesus founded, in the reality of Jesus' kingdom, if you really pay attention to what Jesus is saying. You would not typically say that the guy who has that understanding and knowledge is the warrior. Which I did intentionally because I thought that was very interesting. I hadn't actually worked it all out in my mind how that could be true, though. And that means I'm about to the spot where I actually have to figure out how that could be true. There was just a weird noise in the back of the car. I'm really hoping that my back wheels are not getting ready to fall off here. So I'm at that point now where in this book, we're going to have to work that out. and at least not work it out completely, at least hint at it. So now I have to figure out what that is and how that's just not a huge ball of contradictions to have a warrior prophet and still be true to all the true principles of the kingdom. I was talking to my buddy that I had breakfast with this morning, and I said to him at one point, we were talking about something else, and I said, because death is a kingdom process. And he kind of looked at me and grinned. I think he knew what I meant. And I said, if you look at the parables of Jesus and you look at what Jesus taught, death is a kingdom process. Jesus says, unless the seed fall to the ground and die. And he was talking about himself, but Jesus as our model very much anticipated and very much participated in his own death. And he calls us to be his disciples. So exactly what does that mean? How does that work out in the context of me, my, make sure I still continue to exist? I have to survive. How does it exist in that context? And how does it exist in the context of a warrior? So it's going to be interesting. It's going to be interesting because kind of kicking right off in this opening of this book, I've got to start hinting at this, but I really need to get it figured out first. And probably what's going to happen is what usually happens, and that is I'm just going to jump into it and keep trying to get closer and keep trying to get closer, and then I'm going to have some epiphany, some moment of clarity. I was talking to my buddy about that this morning as well. That one of the reasons I love writing is that the technical side of me and the technical part of what I do doesn't contain a ton of surprises. It's, you know, lining them up and knocking them down. But writing, when I'm writing, I'm in a fog. Let me drop off this mail real quick here. Make sure everything's addressed correctly and it's got stamps on it and it's sealed. I think we're good. That'll take care of my withholding tax for the first quarter. It'll take care of my annuity contribution. Blah, 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 blah. So it's very, it's interesting. It's writing is being in this fog, and I was talking to him about those moments of clarity where, you know, you think you're not sure where you're going, and then you just keep writing, and then suddenly, oh, that's what's supposed to happen. Then poof, you're off in that direction. So those are fun. Those are fun to experience, but it does put you, can put a writer in an uncomfortable position where what has to happen is you just have to keep moving forward. Just keep your fingers moving. And as you keep your fingers moving, something will happen. So it'll be interesting to see how that works out. I'm very interested to see how that works out. Frankly, I've been looking forward to seeing how this is going to work out for several weeks now when I started seeing that it was heading my way. How does the warrior prophet relate to Jesus's true nature of the kingdom? What space is there for a warrior prophet? Because I think Macduff would have already thought about this. He would have thought about this long and hard. And in fact, there's a reason he would have, that isn't going to be revealed for multiple books. I haven't figured out which book on that one, but there's a story there. So anyways, so that's all going well. It's interesting, and I'm not going to have any trouble at all hitting 10,000 words this week. I'd really like to maybe get a little bit ahead, maybe get to 11,000 or 12,000 would be great, because I had 6,000 words of just getting the characters and terminology put together, which is kind of the get you caught up. But I mean, that's 6,000 words compressed down to the essential elements of what is in the first four books over 500,000 words. So, you know, I don't feel too bad about that, because that's like 1%. But, you know, so because of that, that's pretty easy to write. You're not really trying to be artistic. You're just trying to jam out the facts. And so, yeah, it was not too bad. But that gave me a leg up on getting started. And so on Sunday, where I would normally try to put down 3,000 words, I actually put down 6,000 words. And so as it comes up towards the end of this week, one would think that 11 or 12,000 words would be doable. Anyways, so it'll be fine. One way or another, it'll be fine. It's just to keep to my schedule. 2 books a year. I really need to do 80,000 words by June 1st. So it is going to be interesting. Anyways, so this week, I thought I'd talk about the cathedral this week, but I got a little short on time, and I didn't really have enough time to go and re-listen to the podcast that I had listened to before to talk about the cathedral, and I wanted to go do that. I think we mentioned it on the 7 years worth of podcasts episode, that, except we mentioned it the first time we recorded it, that wasn't really recording, and then I just mentioned it in passing when we re-recorded and said, ah, I'll cover that later. So I've got to get back to that. We'll probably do that next week. It was just this week I was a little short on time, and I wanted to get on to writing, and so I didn't do it this week. But I came across a TED Talk, that was just fun. It was fun. And the name of the TED Talk was In the Mind of a Master Procrastinator. It was given by a man named Tim Urban, who has kept a blog. Surprisingly enough, he's been able to keep a blog for some time now on procrastination. Because he freely admits to be a procrastinator. And he was kind of going through some of the stuff that he's faced and some of the things that he's done. And, you know, for me, Lance, I listen to this and it just makes me cringe. But I do have firsthand experience with people in my life who fit this model. And I had actually developed my own terminology for a lot of the things that he talks about in here along the way. And I do think there is a reason for all this. And I would really hope that there is a process whereby someone can grow beyond procrastination. I would just really hope that that is true. My buddy that I was talking to this morning, we were talking about maintaining calmness, maintaining how we are pleasant, you know, maintaining this gentleness, and he was talking to me about who he perceives that I am, you know, a gentle person and a caring person and someone who tries to communicate well and all those kind of things. And we were reflecting on our backgrounds and how he said, I said one of the great things I think I have in my background is I have a mom. My mom is very flamboyant, Italian, you know, never met someone she didn't know, you know, I mean, at least not for very long. I mean, she was always never met someone who couldn't be a friend. She would just strike up conversations with people and could talk to anybody and trained me to talk to anybody. But it was just great, fabulous, extrovert. My dad, complete opposite, introvert, but my dad got all the mechanical genius genes, you know? I mean, his dad and his family, the men were just, when it came to mechanical things, you know, no one had to train them how to be a mechanic. They could just take stuff apart and put it back together and make it work. They had that mechanical genius. And I said, you know, it's just spectacular to have those, both of those sides, and get those mixed together. And my friend I was having breakfast with said, well, there's something else that you had too. And he said, you grew up in the Philippines, and they're very warm people and hospitable and gracious people and don't lose face. And I said, well, that's true. He said, I grew up in India where everybody's in your face and, you know, they're yelling at each other. And I said, I grew up in a fairly aggressive family. But we got to talking about that, you know, the promotion of quietness and how do you practice the promotion of quietness. And I said, because there are things that tend to rage in me. And he said, give me an example. He said, I can't imagine that things are actually raging in you. And so I gave him some examples and how I handle them and what the strategies are and all that kind of stuff. And what I would hope about that is that there would be some tools that he would hear that have been useful for me that he could then maybe take and apply in his own life, which is the reason I told him those things. In much the same way, in talking about this procrastination stuff, I would hope that maybe somewhere somebody who is listening to this would be able to take some of these tools and employ them to get beyond this procrastinating lifestyle. because this, if I had to live like this, I would die of stress. Because this guy's talking about, so in college, I was a government major, which means that I had to write up a lot of papers. He said, now a normal student kind of spreads out the work. He said, I got a paper in 3 weeks. So every day works on it a little bit, you know, does research, kind of gets to that last day, polishes it up, turns it on. He said, basically, I'd take all that work and just do it on the last day. I would just wait till the last day and then write all night. He didn't really want to do it that way, but it would just work out that way. He said he always had a plan that he would work on it all along, but the paper would come along and then everything would get moved to the end because he'd just put it off. And he said, then came my 90-page senior thesis that you're supposed to spend a year working on. And he said, so I mapped it out. He said, well, great, you know, first, whatever, 2 or 3 months, I'm going to do this amount of work, and the next 2 or 3 months, I'm going to do more work, and the next, and I thought, this is great, you know, this is just great. I'll just walk up these stairs like this, a little more work, it'll be great. He said, then, of course, first couple of months went by, and he didn't really get around to doing it at all. And so then he revised his plan to do more work later, and that didn't actually happen. And he said, and then one day he woke up, and he had 3 days until the deadline, and he hadn't written a word. He said, so I did the only thing I could. He said, I wrote 90 pages over 72 hours, pulling not one, but two all-nighters. And he said, you know, humans are not supposed to pull two all-nighters. He said, I sprinted across campus, dove in slow motion, and got it in just at the headline. Oh, this would drive me crazy to live like this. And he said, I thought that was the end of everything, but a week later he gets a call, and it's a school, and they say, is this Tim Urban? And I say, yeah, and they say, we need to talk about your thesis. And he says, okay, and he says, and they say, it's the best we've ever seen. And of course, the whole TED crowd gasped, and then he waited a minute, and he said, yeah, that did not happen. He said, but I just wanted one moment when people actually thought that happened. He said, it was not a good thesis. Which, how can it be? You know, you're under the gun, you're writing like a maniac. He said, it wasn't good. He said, it just wasn't good. And he said, my behavior has perplexed the non-procrastinators around me, like me, and I wanted to explain to the non-procrastinators of the world what goes on inside the head of procrastinators, why we are the way we are now. Okay, that's changeable. We'll get to that. He said, so, he said, he claims that he found an MRI lab that would actually let him do this, and so he, you know, took pictures of his brain and then took pictures of other people's brains that weren't procrastinators and compared them. And he said, very clearly, there's a difference. So he said, for instance, this is a non-procrastinator's brain. And he has this crude hand drawing up on the screen and this stick figure holding like the wheel steering a ship. And it's labeled rational decision maker. And he said, this is most people. They have a rational decision maker that's figuring out what's going on. He said, this is the brain of a procrastinator. And the rational decision maker is still there. But there is also there is also the instant gratification monkey. So, and he said, here's the problem. He said, you got the instant gratification monkey. So he said, you're sitting there, and the rational decision maker is saying, well, we need to do something productive. And the instant gratification monkey doesn't like that, so he takes the wheel. And this is one of his examples. He says, let's actually read the entire Wikipedia page of the Nancy Kerrigan-Tanya Harding scandal, because I just remembered that happened. And then they go to the fridge to check out what's in the fridge. And after that, they go on a YouTube spiral, he says, that starts with videos of Richard Feynman talking about magnets and ends much, much farther away with us watching interviews with Justin Bieber's mom. Okay, I have seen this happen. I have seen this happen close up. Anyways, and so he goes on to talk. I'm backing into my garage. One moment. He says, you know, the instant gratification monkey is not something that you really want to be in charge of your life, and yet it is. And he said, there's only one solution for the instant gratification monkey. And he said, that is, let me just skip ahead here because I'm already... And for the procrastinator, that conflict ends in a certain way every time, leaving him spending a lot of time in the fun and easy place. And he said, I call that the dark playground, because he was talking about the dark playground isn't actually fun, where you're just doing what's easy and fun and whatever. He said the fun you have in the dark playground isn't actually fun because it's completely unearned. Oh, someone is calling me. One moment. There's a reason for that ringtone. Hey, it's Steve Dorland, my buddy. I'm going to go on pause. Okay, well, that was exciting. Oh, we're actually stressing our systems a little bit. This week and the next and the next. It's a long story, and we're actually... did something that we knew would cause ripples, and we thought we had them all under control, but you never know till you try it. So we just found our first exception. But, you know, that's okay. Moving forward. Anyway, so you got this monkey gets behind the wheel, instant gratification monkey. And the problem is that even when the monkey's in charge, he said, when I talk to people about this, what non-procrastinators don't understand is playing in the dark playground is not actually fun. He said it's completely unearned. He said the air is filled with guilt, dread, anxiety, and self-hatred, all of those good procrastinator feelings. And he said the question is, in this situation with the monkey behind the wheel, how does the procrastinator ever get himself over to the place where he's doing something beneficial of value, where the really important stuff comes? And then he labeled this, well, the panic monster shows up. Which the reason I'm laughing is because I had another terminology for it that I used to say when it finally hit people's panic levels. And I used to say, you know, there are some people where their panic response gets invoked a lot sooner than later. And other people, it takes a long time for the panic. So he says, now the panic monster is dormant most of the time, but he suddenly wakes up anytime a deadline gets too close or there's danger of public embarrassment, a career disaster, or some other scary consequence. And importantly, he's the only thing the monkey is terrified of. Now, he became very relevant in my life pretty recently, he said, because the people of TED reached out to me about 6 months ago, invited me to do a TED Talk. And he said, it's always been a dream of mine to have done a TED Talk in the past. Of course, that's a funny line. So, you know, he said, of course, his rational decision maker was saying, okay, wait a minute. Are you sure you understand what you just accepted? Do we get what's going on here? It's going to be happening one day in the future. We need to sit down and start working on this right now. And he said, and the monkey says, totally agree, but let's just open up Google Earth and zoom into the bottom of India like 200 feet above the ground. And scroll up for 2.5 hours till we get to the top of the country so we can get a better feel for India. And he said, so that's what we did that day. This would just drive me nuts. Anyways, so he goes on and he said he finally starts working on the talk and, you know, blah, 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 blah. And he said, what's interesting to him is he said how someone like me could spend 2 weeks unable to start the opening paragraph sentence of a paper and then miraculously find the unbelievable work ethic to stay up all night and write 8 pages. Which, you know, again, comes back to what I was talking about earlier, that you can't wait for inspiration to strike. You can't wait. Well, you can if you're a procrastinator. But my big secret weapon is I just don't wait. I just force the fingers to start going, you know, and then we deal with it later. Anyways, so he talked about the fact that when he started doing his blog, a lot of people started writing, bankers, painters, engineers, lots and lots of PhD students. And he said they're all expressing these feelings of frustration. Why can't I this? Why can't I that? You know, blah, 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 blah. And he said one of the really sad things about all of this is he said since the instant gratification monkey only responds to the panic monster, he said there are certain things in life that don't have a panic monster. He said when you're looking at a career where like you have to be a self-starter, like something in the arts or entrepreneurial, and there's no deadlines on those things at first, there's nothing because there's nothing happening, he said, if you're waiting for the panic monster to do something, you never get it. And so those things like spending time with your family or exercising, taking care of your health, working on your relationship, getting out of a relationship that isn't working, it just never gets done. You just keep floating through. And, you know, I've seen that happen. Now, he tried at the very end to kind of bring some perspective to it, to try to help people see that there is a huge deadline in the truest sense of the word. He didn't use that, but that's really what he was doing. There's a deadline in life. He put a picture up on the screen of all these boxes. And he said, every single one of these boxes represents a week if you live to be 90. And he said, we need to stare at this grid and fill in these boxes as to where we are so that we can see that's how much time we have left. It is the deadline. He didn't use that term, but that's a good term. Anyways, I'm sure it's not original with me. It just occurred to me. So the thing about it is, on all this, though, is that he has a really interesting explanation with the panic monster and the instant gratification monkey and the rational decision maker. And it's all fine and well. It does describe the issue. It does not necessarily provide any solutions, though. Because you can't really just say to people, well, don't do that. Because that doesn't work. And it's like I was talking to my friend today that I feel like one of the most important things, first steps in any improvement in life, is to recognize that there's two voices within you. This is just the basic standard stuff. There's two voices in you. There's a voice of destruction and there is a voice of life. There's the voice of the flesh. There's the voice of the spirit. And the voice of the flesh is the instant gratification monkey. And the voice of the spirit is more than just the rational decision maker. It's much more. It's deeper. It's broader. It's brilliant. It's wise. But we really have a choice in our lives as to which one we're going to listen to. And it's like I told my friend this morning, learning to identify the voice of the flesh within you is crucially important. And one of the ways you combat against following that voice then is to figure out what lie the flesh is trying to tell you and then speaking truth to that so that, that the power of that lie dissipates. And I gave him an example of that kind of stuff. But in this case, you know, what should be happening internally in this guy's life is when the instant gratification monkey says, oh, well, let's go spend the next 2.5 hours just looking at India. What needs to happen is he needs to say, the assumption there is that's going to be fun and that's going to be better than actually getting something productive done. And that's a lie. It's an absolute lie. It's not fun and easy. It's destructive. Because it robs me of the time that I need in my life to be constructive. So, yes, I can call it fun and easy if I want to go along with what the flesh is trying to sell me, or I can call it for what it is. It's destructive. It's a waste of time. And it means that I will earn for myself some destructive reward. And if you put it in those terms, and you put it in terms of, and you, my instant gratification monkey, are not my friend. You, in fact, are doing everything you can to breed an environment of destruction around me. And that's the truth. So I can either listen to you and be plopped right in the middle of an environment of destruction, or I can decide that I know what you're really selling, and it's not fun and easy, it's destruction. And I can turn away and say, I'm not listening to you. Now, the instant gratification monkey is going to say, no, here, fun, look, fun. I mean, he's still going to. But if you then just put yourself in motion, and keep telling yourself, that is destructive. I'm not doing that. I need to be moving in this direction. I don't know how I'm going to accomplish anything because I'm so distracted, but I'm just going to keep moving in this direction. I don't know what I'm supposed to write for a paper, but I'm going to put my fingers in motion. I am going to turn on the computer. I'm going to get the blank Word document up, and I am going to start moving my fingers. And as those words start coming up there and I start getting my brain focused around that, I'm going to slog through this. Because every time I reach over for something fun and easy, I'm going to remind myself that's destructive because I have to speak the truth to that. Because as long as I image this, is this cute little cartoon instant gratification monkey that just wants me to have fun. As long as I image it as that, it's going to be really hard for me to do something constructive But if I image it as the voice of the destroyer within me, if I image it as something that is scheming, that is laughing at me, that is trying to make me look like a fool, that's trying to make me fail, that is an enemy of my soul, it's going to be a little bit easier to say, no, I don't think we're going to spend the next hour just watching YouTube video after YouTube video. Because there's nothing in that that's going to bring me life. It's just going to waste an hour of my life for very little benefit. This is Phil Farron, and I have made it home.